Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
You're listening to Hot Grease. I'm your host, Nicole Taylor. Today, we'll be talking soul food and Deborah's Dinner Series. I am super excited to have, I think for like the third or fourth time on Hot Grease, Mr. Adrian Miller. Adrian, welcome to Hot Grease.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on your show.
And congratulations on your new book, Soul Food, The Surprising Story of an American Cuisine, One Plate at a Time. I've been waiting for this, and I'm so excited to have you on, Adrian.
Great.
So first up, I feel as if Southern food has dominated the headlines the past few years, but definitely in the past few months. Definitely in June, soul food really took center stage. What do you think about all of the New York Times and blog headlines about Paula Deen and soul food and black food waste?
I was just thrilled that it actually got to the forefront of the discussion and that so many different voices weighed in on the subject. Because before that, I mean, you just really only heard about Southern food. You didn't even really hear about soul food or the contributions of African Americans to Southern cuisine. So I was glad, I mean, the circumstances are unfortunate, but I was glad to see that discussion get out there in a broader format.
Totally. One of the things that I found very interesting is that the disappearing of so many soul food restaurants. I did not realize that they're like leaving and dropping like flies almost.
Right, which is really weird given the popularity of Southern food, of which soul food has a lot of overlap. But I think a lot of things are going on. One of it is that it's just hard to run a restaurant. And so what I found in city after city is that there's just no interest among the kids of the original founders of the restaurant or their employees to keep it going. I mean, the one stark example that kind of bucks that trend is Edna's changing to Ruby's in Chicago, where the employees got together after Edna's death. And this is a soul food joint on the west side of Chicago, and they decided to pull their money together and keep it going. But the other stark reality is that just a lot of African Americans are not patronizing these restaurants. So it's just hard to keep them going.
One of the things that I would love to see, I mean, I only think of a few soul food joints that have come out with cookbooks, one being Sylvia Woods, the late Sylvia Woods. I think they have about two cookbooks. But with the proliferation of Southern books that are coming out this fall and have come out in 2013, do you think that soul food restaurants need to look at possibly continuing their legacy and putting it in print in terms of cookbooks?
Absolutely, and I don't know what it is about soul food cooks, but it is hard to get a recipe out of them sometimes. You know, sometimes you don't have to put everything down, just enough so the person has some guidelines. But I think that soul food restaurants could definitely leave their mark and contribute to the dialogue if they put out more cookbooks. You see a lot of privately published cookbooks, and that just goes from soul food joint to soul food joint. But I think they need to get out in the broader market.
Totally. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk more soul food with soul food scholar, Mr. Adrian Miller. Keep listening. We'll be back in a sec.
Tonight, I just want to hold you.
Ooh, you're listening to Let It Go by the California Honey Drops on Hot Grease, www.heritageradionetwork.org.
Just let it go now. I ain't looking for no showdown. So won't you open up that door? Tell me once some more.
Welcome back to Hot Grease. We're chatting with Adrian Miller. We're doing Soul Food 101, really breaking down Adrian's new book, Soul Food, The Surprising Story of an American Cuisine, One Plate at a Time. So we've talked about soul food, and we keep using the word. How do you define soul food? I think a lot of people get really confused when they hear the term.
Rightfully so, because soul food has changed over time. So originally, it described one traditional cuisine of African Americans, because we've made contributions to Low Country cuisine and Creole cuisine and also the cuisine of the Chesapeake Bay area. But it was really the food of the interior South, what we call the Deep South or the Black Belt South. And as millions of African Americans left that part of the country to settle in other parts, they tried to recreate home by either cooking the familiar ingredients from the South or substituting them. And it was that effort at looking at that kind of emerging cuisine, a national cuisine, that became got the name soul food. So now I call it the national cuisine of African Americans.
Some people think or equate soul food to the 70s and the whole movement of black power and soul music. But in your book, you really talk about that the term soul food was coined way before that. Do tell.
Yeah, so that was a surprising find. So it goes back to the days of Shakespeare. He put it in his first play, The Two Gentlemen of Verona, where two women were looking at this hunky guy named Proteus, and Julia says, "Knowest thou not that his looks are my soul's food?" And then, two girlfriends were getting together and calling the guy yummy. But it had a religious connotation for 400 years, so it meant reading your, listening to a sermon, reading your scriptures, doing anything to edify your spiritual life. And it wasn't until the 1940s that it took a musical turn with jazz artists trying to take soul, take jazz music to a place where white artists could not copy it so easily. And those were the sounds of the rural black church. And that sound they called funky or soul, and soul is the name that stuck.
Also, a very interesting fact in your book is that, you know, the transition, you reference Starving the South, a book by Andrew Smith, Andy Smith, and you talk about how, you know, for a time period, black slaves or enslaved Africans were eating a certain type of food, and then during the Civil War in the South, both cultures, being the enslaved Africans and whites, kind of merged together because they had to eat food that what I would call lowbrow food.
Yeah, so the Civil War so disrupted the South that there was a lot of chronic hunger, and so foods that people normally disdained for social status reasons, you know, they had to survive. And so that's where a lot of people point to kind of the overlap between Southern and soul food in terms of whites and blacks were eating pretty much the same things. But one of the things I point out in my book is that in more situations than we might let on, blacks and whites were eating the same things during the slave period in the antebellum South. So there's just a lot. There's a much more shared heritage food-wise than otherwise believed.
So I want to talk a little bit about the structure of your book, which I think is absolutely perfect. You basically lay out what I call the essentials and soul food. How did you come up with this list? Because I feel like a lot of things are missing, and some people would feel like you're spot on. Did you write more chapters but decided at the end that you need to take out some? And what were those chapters?
So before I actually got into the meat of the book, I just did a lot of informal surveying of my friends, the elders, and just looking around. And from that, I started to think, okay, if somebody was sitting down to have a soul food meal anywhere on the planet, what are they likely to have? And these things emerged as probably the most consistent things that would be on the plate. So quickly, the entrees would be fried chicken, fried catfish, or chitlins. The sides would be black-eyed peas, macaroni and cheese, greens, and sweet potatoes, and then a side of cornbread, and then some hot sauce, you know, because you got to put some hot sauce on there, some red Kool-Aid to wash it down, or some kind of red drink, and then the dessert could be peach cobbler, banana pudding, pound cake, or sweet potato pie.
So what's the thing that people said, Adrian, you forgot to put X on
the
list?
Yeah, so the most popular thing I got was okra.
Oh.
Which you just don't see outside the South so much, although it's becoming more of a bar food in its fried form. And then one very nice elderly lady yelled at me. She's like, "How dare you not put in their neck bones?" And I said, "Okay, I'm sorry. You know, can't include everything."
Yeah. I want to focus a little bit on the Liquid Soul 101. I never really equate the red drink or red sodas to soul food because I didn't drink up with that. I always equated sweet tea as a part of soul food. So do tell about this whole red drink Kool-Aid as one of your essentials in soul food. And you really broke down the history of red drinks.
Yeah, so what I noticed in my research, and just from my own experience, is that whenever there's a communal setting or in a soul food restaurant, there usually is some kind of red drink. It could be Kool-Aid, it could be fruit punch, or it could be strawberry soda. And so I was wondering where that came from. And in my research, I found out that two red drinks come across the Atlantic during the slave trade from West Africa to the Americas. And we've all had them. They are cola. And, you know, people are like, what are you talking about, dude? Colas are brown. But they're actually white cola nuts and red cola nuts. And so a red cola tea was very popular. And then hibiscus tea, also known as sorrel in the Caribbean, or agua de Jamaica in Mexican restaurants, is made from a West African flower. And again, that's a tea. And what I found out is the same formula as Kool-Aid. Get some water, color it red, sweeten it to taste. And so after emancipation, in the early emancipation celebrations, you see red lemonade all reported all over the place. And then it turns into red soda pop as carbonated beverages became more prevalent. And then the advent of Kool-Aid in the 1920s made it really spread red drinks around. And then you just see it all over the place.
So, and you would include Bisop.
Yes.
In that same, that's a West African Senegalese, I think it's the official drink of Senegal, in that whole red drink phenomenon. Amazing. Totally amazing about the red drink thing, because I didn't really equate that to West Africa, the whole red drink and the red cola. Fascinating information. So keeping soul food alive. You know, I feel like soul food has a bad, you know, people talk badly about soul food, you know. What do you think about that, and how do we keep soul food alive? It is a cultural, a part of our cultural heritage. And what advice do you give to folks who say, no, I don't want soul food, or they call soul food, because I was one of those folks in my 20s, I call soul food slave food, and I had a total bad connotation with it. I was trying to run away from it.
Yeah. So I think three things need to happen. One is that soul food needs to get a makeover. And my book is part of that effort, because I want people to understand where it comes from and to understand that a lot of the things that dietitians and nutritionists are recommending for us to eat are in soul food. I mean, that's the building blocks of soul food. Fish, dark leafy green vegetables, sweet potatoes, beans, rice, all of that stuff is part of soul food. So it's a matter of just making it in a different way. Two, I think we need to have people making it at home. We need to have soul food cooked more often, so it has to be more accessible. And I think the way that can happen is if we have more media images of soul food, positive media images of soul food and soul food cooks, and we get more of these cookbooks that we were talking about earlier out into the mainstream so people are cooking it at home. And I think that can turn the tide. I think with this foodie movement that we're in now, there are more young people getting interested in cooking. And so I hope they don't toss aside soul food as something that just doesn't even need to be on the plate, instead of thinking it as a cultural art form that should be celebrated.
Totally. Speaking of cookbooks, I have to shout out, you have launched this amazing project around cookbooks and race. Please tell me all about it. How can folks be a part of the movement and the cookbook club?
Yeah, so with the discussions with Paula Deen and what happened with the Trayvon Martin trial, and then what the Supreme Court did with the Voting Rights Act, I just kept seeing people saying, we need to have a conversation on race. And I used to work in the Clinton White House on something called the Initiative for One America, where we were all about trying to foster these racial dialogues. And what I found is that typically it's race is a difficult subject, and you have to find another hook to get people to the table. And what better way to do it than with food? And so I thought if people could just read a cookbook by a white Southerner and a black Southerner, and then analyze them, make some dishes from them, and then get together for a potluck meal, you could start to break down those barriers and start talking about different difficult subjects like race. So they can look at the Zester Daily website, or you can contact me at soulfoodscholar.com, and I can give you more information about it.
What are examples of some of the pairings that you have?
So just to go to the heart of the matter, I paired one of Paula Deen's family cookbooks with a cookbook called Cooking the Dufusky Way by Sally Ann Robinson. And she's from the Gullah people. And so I thought that kind of comparison would be a really strong one to see how people from the same region can have similar food traditions, but they can go off into interesting different directions. So that's one of the best pairings I thought of. And then also, just for the old school types, Edna Lewis's and The Taste of Country Cooking is a classic. And I thought about Marjorie Rawlings' Cross Creek Cookery, which shows kind of the cooking of whites in rural Florida. So I thought that was a good contrast.
Oh, wow. Very nice. Adrian, thank you so much for coming on Hot Grease. I totally, totally appreciate it. Congratulations on this book. This book, I'm telling you, folks, it is something that you need to have on your shelf if you're, you know, you have questions about, I don't understand this about, you know, pork and black people not eating pork or all these cultural nuances around food. This book is the book that you should start with and read. It's a great book. Congratulations, Adrian. Thanks for stopping by Hot Grease. Folks can find you. You're on Twitter and all that stuff at Soul Food Scholar, right?
Yep, soulfoodscholar.com.
There you have it. Thanks so much, Adrian. Talk to you soon.
All right, peace.
Listeners, we're going to take a short break and come back and talk dinner series to pour us. Dinner series. Keep listening.
This one's called Got the Feeling by the California Honey Drops. Stay tuned for more from Hot Grease.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Did you know that pollinators are needed for more than 2/3 of the world's crop species? Most of these pollinators are bees. However, North America's bee population has been steadily declining since the 1990s. Whether you live in the country or the city, you can show your commitment by hosting a hive in your backyard or even on a rooftop. The beekeeping movement is growing, so you're sure to find swarms of folks who can help you find your way. Learn more about the ways you can help be the solution at wholefoodsmarket.com/sharethebuzz. Day in, day out, it's the same old grind, but you know good
things sometimes they take some. All right, folks, if you're just tuning in, we are talking de porras, dinner series, and in the studio we have Miss Danielle Bell.
Hi.
One half of the dinner series. Welcome to Hot Grease.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, de porras.
Yes.
That word means what?
That word is actually the name of a saint. He's the patron saint of Lima, but also of television and innkeepers. And when Pablo and I were thinking of what to name the series, I went through a number of names. Some were very, very, very kind of straightforward. I don't know. None of them were good enough to come up with. But I was, Pablo has this thing called Santo Palo. It means Hollywood. And it's from a special Andean tree, and you burn it and make a wish. And I started doing that. And with the Palo Santo came an image of this saint whose name was Martin de Porras, and he happened to be a black man and had this amazing story, and it really resonated with me, and I thought, this is kind of sweet. It combines us in this funny way. So it's a person, actually.
So you, Pablo, you're mentioning Pablo. He's the other half of de Porras dinner series, and also your life partner.
Yeah, my life partner.
Your boo.
My boo, my man.
So he's from Lima, Peru, but I just heard you, we were talking earlier. I thought you were from Mississippi, but you said something about Louisville. So
I know why you think I'm from Mississippi. I think you think I am because of Amy Evans Cameron from Southern Food Pathways.
Southern Food Wetlines.
Sorry about that. She met us because we were catering a birthday / divorce party for a woman that had come to our series, and she kind of made her way over to the kitchen and she started to talk. She didn't tell me she was a food writer that I actually follow on Twitter, followed before I had even met her. But she just said, oh, I'm from Mississippi. And I said, oh, I have family roots in Mississippi. And then months later, I never thought about it again, but I had this message on Twitter from her, and she'd written about us and my grandfather, who has a school in Piney Woods.
Yeah, and it's so funny. I went crazy because before reading that piece, I've been introduced to you online.
Yeah.
And when I saw the Piney Woods thing, because I grew up like literally saving Ebony and Jet magazines with all the coverage of Piney Woods. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I want to go to boarding school. How can I go to Piney Woods?
You should have went. I mean, I don't think it's that hard to go there. I think it's pretty affordable. And it's my grandfather's father whose roots are actually from the Midwest. He's not even from there, but he had gotten an education and he decided to go to the very, very, very deep South, and it hardly gets more deep South than rural Mississippi.
Yeah.
And he opened the school. If you ever care to, we can go to my one relative in New York's house. Her name is Dixie Moon. And
oh, she's wow.
Dixie Moon, a woman from Mississippi named Dixie Moon, living in Harlem for the past 60, 70 years. And she keeps she's a bit of a hoarder. She keeps everything written about Piney Woods. So you can see pictures of like Clark Gable there and...
Wow.
You know,
I would love to see that and dig deeper into the food, what the students were eating at Piney Woods.
That's a really good question. I mean, I'm not quite sure what they were eating in Piney Woods. I know my grandfather, Gramps Turner, he's dead now. He always kept canned tamales in the cupboard at my grandmother's house. She's from Memphis. But I never knew why until I found through Southern
Food Alliance.
The tamale trail. Yeah, and it made sense. It's like, this is why we always had cans of tamales in my grandparents' house. So I would like to hope they were eating that. But there's a fair chance that it might have, the politics of the time were often rooted in Black respectability. So I wouldn't be surprised if, for example, the foods were less soul food. Quote unquote. So I wouldn't be surprised.
And Adrian talks about that in the book, the whole, you know, lowbrow, highbrow thing of food. So the dinner series, you really take a part of what you just talked about, your Southern heritage and Southern roots. And Pablo takes his whole heritage of being a Peruvian.
Uh-huh.
Is he from Lima?
He is from Lima.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Lima is like the hottest place now. What's up with that?
Well, the men are hot. Maybe that has something to do with it. No, I don't know what's up with that. I know that for the past 3-4 years, everyone's been saying Peruvian food is going to be the next big thing. And there's been somewhat of a push to try to make that happen. But I don't know that it is going to happen. I mean, Lamar by Gaston Acurio just closed down in Midtown. We do our part because I think Peruvian food is really amazing. And he introduced me to it, and then I have been introducing people to it, or he and I together, because I think it's brilliant. I think it's one of the most dynamic cuisines on the planet.
Yeah.
It's Andean, it's African, it's Chinese, it's Japanese, it's Mediterranean, and it's not, you know, quote unquote fusion. It all came together in many amazing ways, I think.
So you, Pablo focused really on the Peruvian piece, and you focus on the Southern piece, but more so Southern desserts. And I have to say thank you. If you're at your computer now, you can look at my Instagram or Twitter timeline. Danielle brought me the best chess pie. And Jack and Joe said it kind of reminded them of Mama Fuku's crack pie. It's different, though. It's good.
I haven't had the crack pie, but I take that as a compliment.
Yeah, that is a compliment. It's really good. Chess pie is really good, which is a classic Southern dessert. If you have good chess pie, you're having the best Southern food. We're actually going to take a short break. We're going to come back and talk more dinner clubs, secret suppers, the whole big explosion of people dining underground. Keep listening. We'll be back in a sec.
Well, Miss Louise, can't you understand? Well, Miss Louise.
You're listening to Miss Louise by the California Honey Drops. Stay tuned for more from Nicole Taylor and Hot Grease.
So get back your broken heart. Well, Miss Louise, why can't you see? Well, Miss Louise, this could never be.
Welcome back to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. We are talking Deporah's Dinner Series, a Brooklyn-based supper club. Danielle Bell, one half of the supper club, is in the studio. So, Danielle, we have to talk. You guys were just in L.A.
Yes.
And so you did a whole dinner series, not one, like two or three dinner series.
Three,
wow.
Yeah, 3 in 2 weeks.
Tell me about it. Where were you guys?
Well, we were everywhere. Our first dinner was at the home of my friend's mom, a beautiful, beautiful West Side home. And so we did that in the Pacific Palisades. And then our biggest dinner for 25 people was in downtown LA at a gallery called 356 Mission. It's also Laura Owens studio, and it was huge, industrial, amazing, surrounded by art and a few characters. And then we had a third dinner that was different from the other two because it was actually at a home that was, you know, a bit more modest than the sweeping one that we did our first dinner in, but very, very, very nice. And it was outside on a hill and poolside. We did family style for that because we wanted to kind of do, just kind of see how the menus and the mood can change based on place and space.
Yeah.
And it felt more appropriate to serve people, you know, at the table since we were all outside, and it was very, very kind of bohemian. And then that first dinner was special because they had this incredible garden, and they said, oh, you know, you can do anything you want with the garden. So I said, okay. And they had all of these tomatoes that weren't quite ripe yet. So in skinny LA, we served a fried green tomato salad with, you know, cornmeal battered and then cornmeal battered zucchini blossom stuffed with wakatai, which is an Andean black mint and cheese.
Oh,
so
wow.
That was very Pablo Danielle together.
Yeah, where did you guys get the andouille, which is a part of Lima? Where did you get that cheese from?
We used Greek feta for
it.
Sometimes when we do that, we can't find the farmer's cheese, but we often use like a Brebis Blanche or something. It just has to kind of have a lemony sort of fresh feel to it. It works.
What else was on the menu? That sounds awesome.
For that dinner, we did a sudado de pescado, which is a steamed fish with a yellow pepper called ají amarillo. We did a mushroom ceviche. We did the salad. We did a causa, which is kind of like Peruvian potato salad. It's stuffed potatoes, basically, with crab and shrimp in this instance.
Wow.
And I made a chess pie. And then for some of the other dinners, I did cobblers. I made a more traditional French tart from pluots, which I'd never had before.
The plum peach hybrid.
Yeah.
I've
never
really
seen
good.
Them. They're amazing. Yeah. We did a lot of stuff. I mean, there's pictures.
Sounds amazing.
We did tiraditos, which are similar to ceviches, but the literally translates to little tears. So it shows the Japanese influence on Peruvian cuisine. The cuts of fish are more like sashimi. We did a lot of things.
I see. So there was an article. Was it an Eater or was it a Grub Street?
The one you sent me?
Yeah, the article about this whole what they call supper clubs 3.0. I feel like New York City definitely kicked off this whole supper club, underground clubs. I mean, they have so many names now. Culinary salon.
Yeah.
What do you think? What are your thoughts about the transformation of supper clubs at this point?
I'm not sure. I think if people have an idea and they have something that they want to share with people, and the best way they can do it is something, you know, humble, like, you know, come and eat at my house or whatever, let me cook at your house, then I think it's a good thing. I don't know. I mean, I haven't been to enough, or actually any supper clubs, dinner series, whatever you want to call them. The only one I've been to is my own.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So.
Well, that's good. You don't have any. I've gone to a ton of them. Some of them, I've gone to Sarah Simmons,
the City Grit.
I've gone to City Grit. I've gone to others in other cities. I've gone to, you know, pop-up ones from friends that are chefs here. It's a lot of work. Wouldn't you agree? Because I feel like a friend of mine who was doing it, I didn't realize how much time and effort. And she was doing it at her house for like 10 people.
It's a lot of work. But it feels good, I think. I mean, I get to go to L.A. and L.A. was especially gracious to us. We're not really connected with the New York City food scene, to be honest. So, you know, when we were
that
able
can
to,
be a good thing, huh?
I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, it would be great if we, you know, had a lot of press or something like that. But, you know, it comes or it will come. L.A. was actually special for us because, you know, I think in New York you really have to be connected in this way. Whereas in LA, people are just more like, oh, wow, you're doing something cool. Let me, you know, do it at my house or something. Do it at my gallery. Don't pay me anything. Do it at my beautiful gallery, you know. And so, yeah, I don't know. We're just not so connected in New York.
But you guys are doing great. I feel like online, I mean, that's how I found you. People are buzzing about the series. What's next? When is your next series?
Our next dinner in New York, in Brooklyn, which will be at least for another 6 months, will be the last Sunday of this month. We have a few ideas. I'm going to actually be doing Derby Pie, which
cool.
I haven't done in forever. So you're not going to get more Louisville than that. But it's going to be, Pablo's been wanting to do Trinidadian doubles forever. He loves them. So they're going to be on the menu. And a mussel soup that we did in L.A., mussels and a lot of cilantro, called Aguadito de Churros, is going to be on the menu, amongst other things.
That sounds exciting. And are you guys going to go elsewhere? L.A., Brooklyn?
L.A. is calling our name, but, you know, we'll still be here for a bit. It just, there's just something special about it there. I think, I've been trying to think of why our dinners were so much, why there was so much buzz for our dinners, despite not really knowing anyone in L.A. than here. And I don't know, I think people spend a lot of, it's less of a restaurant city. I think people spend a lot of time in their homes. So to have something fabulous in a home is really special in L.A. I don't know. We've been thinking about how and why. Maybe there's just a general sort of California cheer. But
do you
know.
See possibly going to Louisville or Mississippi or
yes,
Charleston?
Absolutely. Louisville for sure. Pablo and my Nana have a really special relationship. And when he came for Christmas, all they did or all we did together was sit around her table. When my Nana cooks, I mean, you think supper clubs are hard work. Well, you know, an 80-year-old woman cooking for, I'm not kidding, 60 people for
wow.
holidays and really cooking for 60 people is hard work. But in between all of her cooking, she and Pablo and I talked, and there was so much crossover, so much, you know, Peruvian Africans started eating heart, anticuchos, and now they're street food in Peru, which we did serve in L.A. And Nana talked about a heart stuffed with rice that her mother would make. And I really want to go to Louisville and cook for my Nana and with my Nana. And, yeah, it would be great to go wherever we're – whoever wants us, we'll go.
We have to connect you with Chef Edward Lee.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, when you're down
there. He's out of my price range when I'm back in Louisville, but I've heard only great things
about
his
food.
Should
connect you so he can come to your dinner series. Danielle, I feel honored to have you. You know, look, next thing I'll look up and then you'll be like, wow, she's on the cover of New York Times.
I'll take that. Thank you.
Thank you, Deporah's Dinner Series. People can find you online.
Yes, DE-Porras, PORRES.com.
There you have it.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on, listeners. Thanks so much for tuning in live, if you're listening live to Hot Grease. I'm going to give a shout out to Joji for producing today's show. Roberta's, they were rocking some hot music. It was almost like the VMAs at Roberta's today, right?
A lot of twerking.
More twerking. Shout out to them. They're the location of Heritage Radio Network. We're located here at 261 Moore Street in Brooklyn, New York. So, folks, if you want to listen to Hot Grease, next month will be 4 years. I think I have over 160 shows. You can go to heritageradionetwork.org. You can go to iTunes. You can go to Stitcher and download all the episodes. But until then, always take the road less traveled.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Just a